Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In this revised, updated, and expanded edition, the author explores the life of Theodore Bundy, one of the more infamous and flamboyant American serial killers on record. Bundy's story is a complex mix of psychopathology, criminal investigation, and the U.S. legal system. This in-depth examination of Bundy's life and his killing spree that totaled dozens of victims is drawn from legal transcripts, correspondence, and interviews with detectives and prosecutors. Using these sources, new information about several murders is unveiled. The biography follows Bundy from his broken family background to his execution in the electric chair. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Bundy Murders, a comprehensive history, second edition, and part two of my interview, Kevin Sullivan. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, part two, Kevin Sullivan.
Well, hi, Dan. I appreciate you having me back. We had a great time last week talking about Bundy and his start of murder and his travels through Washington State, and it's good to be back to finish the story.
Thank you very much. When we last left off, we were talking about Bundy now being officially on this list of 100 suspects, and he was coming just to the top of that list, and Bundy was saying goodbye to Liz and daughter Tina, and heading to Utah. And as you write, he left Seattle September 3rd. However, there are gas receipts that show that Bundy began his journey September 2nd. Tell us about his journey September 2nd and who he encountered near Boise, Idaho.
Well, yes. And actually, I was the first one to discover on the 2nd.
Right.
Liz Kendall says in her book that he left on the 3rd. Most writers have said that he left in early September, but I was able to discover when I was doing the research for the Bundy murders from the gas receipt that he actually left Seattle on September 2nd, which was Labor Day that year. And but now he would arrive in the early morning hours, probably around 4 or 5 a.m. on September 3rd. When I was doing the ABC doc, I actually said that he left on September 3rd. I meant to say September 2nd, and it arrived on September 3rd, but I had a glitch there or something. But my book was the first to come out that he left on the 2nd. And what he did was, and since my book came out, and I put this in the second edition, but there is a really interesting picture. The picture is not in my book. But there was a picture that Mary Lynn Chino took of Bundy on the morning that he left, and what happened that morning, and I write about this aspect in the book. Liz called her Angie, friend, but it's really Mary Lynn Chino or Chino. And they had breakfast or kind of like a brunch on her boat in Seattle. And Bundy was already packed and ready to go, and he stood there at his car, and she snapped a picture of him, and it doesn't include Liz or anyone. It's just Bundy. And what's interesting about the photograph is that Bundy is dressed in white shorts and white socks and tennis shoes and like a polo shirt, and he looked almost identical to how he had dressed on the morning of July 14th of 1974, when he went to Lake Sammamish, where he successfully abducted two women, one in the morning and one at night. And that picture has surfaced in the last couple of years, and so I didn't get to include the picture because, of course, it's copyrighted with her. And I actually wrote about it, and I added that to the book. And you want to call it almost like an iconic photograph. Within about 12 hours of that picture being taken, he would murder the Idaho hitchhiker. And what happened is he had – at the end, Bundy said – first of all, he called Liz from Nampa, Idaho. And Nampa is a place that they had stopped at before. And so it might have sparked some fond, memories in him. And he called Liz from there and spoke to her. Within 30 minutes, he was on, maybe 22, 25 minutes, he was on the outskirts of Boise, and he noticed a girl hitchhiking. She was on the on-ramp and of the freeway, and he had already gotten into a place where there were a lot of, houses in view. And so he picked her up. He stopped for gas in Boise. I got to tell you this, too. There's a guy on social media. He contacted me. It's the craziest thing in the world. I don't know what happened to this guy, but he had no encounter with Ted Bundy. He's told two different completely stories about him seeing Ted Bundy in Boise and how he saw Ted Bundy attack the woman, and then he stood there and had a 10-minute conversation with Bundy. Absolute madness. If anybody hears that out there, this guy is just – it's not true. I just wanted to say that because he's trying to make a name for himself now. In any event, he picked her up. He went to Boise, got gas, and as he was traveling on in a southeasterly direction throughout the nighttime hours on I-84, he kept her, I guess, about maybe 3 or 4 hours, and they talked. But he kept looking and spotting the river, like off to his left, I guess it was. He pulled off on one of these, and I've driven, this route from I-84. It's just nothing but freeway now. But back in Bundy's days, it was partially freeway, and then it would be the old highway, and then it would get back on, and then it would start again as the freeway. And so he pulled off there, and at some point he whacked her in the head, and he dragged her body to where he had parked. He identifies it as being near, again, I think there was a railroad trestle by there, but he probably was able to pull up really close to the river, and he murdered her. He had to have necrophilia with the corpse and maybe sex since he was strangling her. But in any event, he killed her. He dumped her naked body in the river, got rid of her clothes, and that's basically what he did. Now, he wouldn't get to Utah into his apartment at 565 First Avenue, which, by the way, Liz had found for him. But he wouldn't get there probably between maybe 4 and 5 a.m. And I say in the book that while the rest of the city was sleeping, that the malignancy was setting up shop. And, of course, that's basically what it was, because as Bundy got into Salt Lake, he was there to, I'll just tell the audience, to start law school. And it was early September, and he should have started immediately. And instead of that, he would spend the next semester probably only attending about 3 times, and he spent the rest of the time hunting and murdering women. So, he had to go to Utah because he had made Washington State too much of a hotbed of investigative activity. And he knew if he was going to continue to kill women, he would have to look for a new place. By this time, there was absolutely no sense in Bundy that he was going to complete law school. It was merely a cover for what he was doing. So, anyway, and he wouldn't knuckle down until after January and spend more time in law school, but he wouldn't stop his killing even then. So it was a progression. The murders began in Washington State, and they transferred to Utah. And so in September of 1974, he arrived there. He would come back to Utah. He could only move so many things. He would journey back to Utah Yeah, I guess he flew back because he went home to pick up his truck that he had there, and he had purchased this truck apparently from a friend of his named Marlon Bortman, who was an attorney in Seattle, and he got his brother Glenn to help him load this truck, and Glenn and he drove back to Utah and unloaded it, and then that truck stayed there. Even though he had his VW, that truck stayed there, and then Glenn flew back. So I think he got back on September 18th, I believe. I have to check my book to do this loading, and he may have been there a day or two. And then he came back to Utah. And I say in the book that although Bundy was a real planner of murder, and he would watch women, and he would pick who he wanted to abduct or the area he would want to abduct. He'd watch the patterns of women's movements and things like that, where to best park your car so it wouldn't be seen, how far you'd have to walk with the woman as she walked to the car, what's the best way to do it so that less people might notice you. So he was a planner of murder, but at the same time, he was also opportunistic, and he would pick up and kill hitchhikers. So I say in the book that it must have, and back then there was a lot of young girls, you know, young women hitchhiking. It was just big all over the country. And not so much today, but it was all, you just would see it all the time back then. Anyway, so I say in the book that it must have really bothered him as they passed women who would wiggle their delicate thumbs, I think I say, and, you know, yeah, they just had to go by them. But if Bundy were alone, he would have taken the opportunity, even in the midst of a move, to commit murder. But he was restricted because of Glenn's presence.
You write, though, that in that September as well, September 8th, the bodies of Denise Naslin and Janice Ott were discovered lying on a hillside near Issaquah, less than 10 minutes southeast of Lake Sammamish State Park.
Mm-hmm.
And a third set of bones was found there with the two bodies. Tell us a little bit about what Robert Keppel thought about the Issaquah crime scene and what it yielded and what they could learn from that crime scene itself. Meanwhile, like you say, Bundy was on the trip moving back and forth, and then September 12th to November, he started his killing spree there.
Yes.
So let's talk about what they found at this crime scene here.
Well, there were a couple grouse hunters, and Elza E. Rankin was one, and then a fellow with him, and these guys were older men. I think Elza Rankin was born in like 1904, and so this was 74, so he was 72. They had hunted there the previous year before, and this was up in the Issaquah Hills. Now, where Bundy had dumped the remains of Denise Naslin and Janice Ott, if you look on a map, there is a it's a perfect area to dump bodies, but there is a freeway, and then there's a, you can take an exit and get on what is known as the Old Sunset Highway, and that'll lead you up, and then from that direction you can go up to where you can start rising on the hillside on what was a logging road. And Bundy knew these areas so extremely well. And so what he did was, and now we don't know whether this is where he kept them, because he told Hagemeyer later that after he got Janice out in the morning, he kept her alive and then did whatever he, you know, does with his victims. And that later in the afternoon, he got Denise Naslin around 4:20. Janice was, and then murdered one in front of the other. And that was all for psychological torture. Mm-hmm. Now, they were found. They know where these women were found, along with a third set of remains that turned out to be George Ann Hawkins. But there was no skull found of Janice Ott, and there was no skull of George Ann Hawkins found. But authorities aren't sure he might have had them right there in the same area and killed them, or that could be where he dumped them. In any event,
right.
These grouse hunters happened to find some human remains, and they went back to their car, and they also ran into a couple of young fellas. I think one was 19, Jeffrey Hartsfield, I believe was his name, and they were just doing some, shooting, just some plinking. They weren't hunting or anything. And they got in a conversation, and the one fella, and I think it was Elder Rankin, said, there's human remains up there. And the boys didn't think so at all, and they were kind of making a joke about it. So, but these hunters knew they had spotted remains. They knew they had spotted bones. But as they were walking back up, they spotted something that they had missed, and it was the detached hair of Denise Nathlin, and her hair was jet black and shiny. And so here it is, a crime scene, and of course nobody was laughing anymore after they spotted the hair. And in fact, near the hair, not too far away, was what was her skull. Anyway, so it was a stark discovery, and there were a lot of remains there. But still, they couldn't find the head of Janice Ott. That's what the official record says. That's also what Keppel has said. I think Keppel called Issaquah a veritable cache of human remains. But in any event, they wouldn't know for quite some time exactly who the third set of remains were. And, of course, that turned out to be George Ann Hawkins, and Bundy told Keppel that at the end. And they went back, this was 15 years later, when Keppel's getting this confession. So he goes back and he tries to, Bundy gave it. You can hear Bundy on the tape. He's trying to honestly try to give directions of where he buried her skull, he said, on a hillside. And it wasn't too far from where the main remains were found, but Keppel said that the geography of the land, as it were, kind of changed, maybe erosion and things like that. And they were never able to locate it. Some people believe that maybe Bundy lied about that. I don't. He was being exceedingly, exceedingly honest at his end-of-life confessions. And, if Bundy did encounter something he didn't want to talk about, graffiti or whatever, he wouldn't lie about anything, but he would say, well, you know what, that's a little hard for me to talk about now, or I'll have to get back with you about that if it's possible. And that's what he would do. But he was being exceedingly honest. So I think Bundy gave accurate directions as to where they could find the skull, but for some reason they have not been able to find it. And so, as I say in the book, that the skull of George Ann Hawkins remains part of the Issaquah crime scene to this day.
Let's talk about this acceleration, as you write, September 20th to November 8th. He abducted and murdered at least four young women in a six-week period. Nancy Wilcox was 16 years old on October 2nd from Holiday, Utah.
Yeah.
And Melissa Smith, 17, who's a daughter, and this is another even more horrifying aspect of this, a couple of the people he targets are police, detectives, daughters, and even a judge he dates. So just add to the horror of this guy. Melissa Smith, 17, and her father's Louis, her father's Louis Smith. Let's talk about Melissa's body is found in October.
Yes.
And so tell us what police find and discover at that in terms of her being held.
Yes.
What they there discover.
Sure. Sometimes Bundy had a habit of dumping bodies close to either trails or roads, like Denise Nathlin and Janice Ott. They were very close to that logging road. But Melissa Smith's body was found adjacent to the Timberline subdivision, not far at all from houses. And that's in Summit County, Utah. So when a hunter, I can't remember the fellow's name, but he's in my book, found her. He called Summit County Sheriff Ron Robinson's office and, you know, reported that there's a young female, white young female, dead in this in this oak area right next to Timberline Subdivision. Anyway, being short on manpower, he calls in the help of the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. And it turns out that Ben Forbes, which is Jerry Thompson's partner, came out to the scene. I think the girl, I think Melissa was discovered, I don't know if it was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but by 4 p.m., Ben Forbes, Detective Forbes, was headed to the scene. The captain of the homicide division there, which is Pete Hayward, he also came out there, and there was a patrol officer. I can't remember his name. But Forbes, I have the report. Forbes did, you know, he did the report, and I say in the book that they had no idea at that moment who was lying before them or what a terrible problem they had breathing down their necks. And at this point, you got to remember that the first one to disappear that we know of was Nancy Wilcox, 16, but there was, but she's still considered a runaway. I mean, they just don't know what happened to her, but now here they have a body. And Melissa Smith, when Forbes started looking at her, and he said he squatted down and looked at her, he thought he saw a bullet wound of contact in her skull. But it was not. She was not shot in the head. That was the extreme damage done by Bundy's crowbar. He also made a determination because she disappeared on October 18th and was not discovered on the hillside in Summit County until October 28th, which you can see that's, you know, 10 days. October 27th, so that's 9 days. And he said he estimated the time of death between 30 and 36 hours. And I say in the book, even if you double that time, Melissa had to have been kept somewhere alive, but probably in a comatose state for some time. Now, later at the end, Bundy admitted taking Wilcox to his apartment, Debbie Kent to his apartment. He said he only had her there one day. And I've talked to Mike Fisher about this, and he also believed that Melissa Smith was there, as well as Laura Ann Amy. Again, Laura Ann Amy, and I'm just going to we'll talk about her later, but I'll throw this out. She disappeared on Halloween night, October 31st, cross over to November 1st in the middle of the night. And she wasn't discovered until Thanksgiving, which I believe was on the 27th of November that year. She, too, had not been dead that long. And I've seen the crime scene photos of her. And most people have never seen these. But I have seen them. And it wasn't that cold. So we're not talking she was frozen in sun, not anything like that. And she was very pristine looking. But in any event. You know, here's Forbes. He's squatted down. He's looking at her. Pete Hayward's standing there. The officer is standing there, and they're gathering as much information. Forbes does an excellent job describing the body and how it, you know, it was laying there. And of course, later they found out, of course, it was, you know, Melissa Smith. And we talked about in the last section how she disappeared after leaving the pepperoni pizza place, and how Bundy had been drinking at the same time that she's there, or just a little bit earlier than that, and Bundy ran into Louise Cannon, who I interviewed for my book, The Bundy Secrets, and she knew Ted, and he was really, you know, he was not very talkative. It was unlike him, and of course, he was jump-starting himself with alcohol. He's sitting at the bar drinking, and he was reserved, subdued, because he was transforming into that altered state to go hunting for women, and it was soon after he left the bar. Louise was there to meet several friends. They went to a table. Next time she looked over, Ted was gone. And so from there, he must have made his way a very short distance from the bar, which was called the Widow McCoy's. And that was, there's a new one there today in Utah, in Salt Lake City, but this was at the other location, not too far from the pizza place. So he made his way over there, and in some form or fashion, was able to abduct Melissa Smith. So anyway, as can be expected, and of course, Jerry Thompson, the investigator, the lead investigator for most of these cases in Utah, he said that he was good friends with Lewis Smith, and when it became known by the general public, women were starting to disappear, and that somebody had, you might say, the audacity to have murdered the Midvale police chief, Lewis Smith's daughter. A lot of people began to realize that really no one was safe. I mean, if you have a female in your family, you're going to have to watch her. And some people, I even quote a fellow in there named Dino Anderson. He was the police chief of Balfour, Utah. And he said after the Kent abduction on November 8th, he said, I used to think Balfour was a safe place, but, he said, I can't say that anymore. But I say in the book that police officers, above all people, know that any village, town, or hamlet, wherever you go, has the possibility of having pure evil raise its head and strike. And so most cops would go, yeah, this is a nice community, and chances are that won't happen again like that. But even in the book, I put a picture of Vimal High School up, and I say, very deep within the neighborhood, it was an unlikely place for abduction, and that's true. But unlikely doesn't mean it can't happen. So, in any event, it really affected people with the Melissa Smith murder, and of course, that's just the second. And he still had Laura and Amy to snatch down in, like, south of Salt Lake City. And again, as I say, he would grab her. She was hitchhiking, actually. The police believe that she was hitchhiking on a darker portion of Highway 89. And Highway 89 runs in and becomes State Street. And State Street is a main drag going out of Salt Lake City, both north and south. Well, she was south. She was down near Orem. And, again, she wouldn't be found. Now, I believe we can't prove this, but I believe that all these women at different times were kept at Bundy's apartment. Now, I've always believed that he had them in the apartment at least for a time, or since they have found a cellar now, when I wrote the Bundy murders, I was not aware that there was a cellar at 565 First Avenue, because if you're looking at the front of the house, it's in the rear but on the side, and it's got a door that shuts and locks. Well, people have said that they have heard, that lived there, had heard that Bundy had that, was going down there all hours of the night. Now, the reason why he could do that and feel like he was safe to do that is because that door that shuts on top locks, and because he was like the maintenance man, he was kind of like the property manager. He would show a room sometimes, and he would cut the grass. He had that, but I don't believe he just used the cellar. I believe he went up to his room, so especially if he was going to keep somebody as long as maybe Melissa Smith or Laura Ann Amy. And I've always felt that. I felt it would be the kind of crime that Bundy would do. And I've told people, think of the Linda Ann Healy abduction in reverse, where he carried her out of the university district in the middle of a university area in the middle of the night. He could do the same thing, taking women up there. Well, here's the thing. He basically comes out and confirms it. He confirms it with Stephen Michaud, during a taped interview. And Michaud's talking about that. He talks about carrying people in and out of apartments. And basically, people can look it up. In fact, I've got the quotes from these books in my sixth and final Bundy book that's coming up, that'll be released in, my publisher told me, late November. And it talks about this. And so Bundy said is he just felt, basically he said, I felt like I was invincible. That no, I could walk through walls. So my feeling is this. I don't think he'd have kept them in this dang cellar for 4 or 5 days when he could have the comfort of being upstairs. And if he was, like he said to Michaud, that he could feel like he could do anything, it's in the middle of the night. I've been to that place, 565 First Avenue, twice. You can walk from the back, or he could have parked his car on the driveway, carried somebody up the steps, up the thing. It would take him less than a minute. And we're normal. You know, we're normal people. Oh, my God, we would never do that. But Bundy would. So I believe he kept them both in his room as well as the cellar. For example, he said about the Debbie Kent abduction, he said, I only had her one day. And, in fact, for the sixth book, I transcribed his end-of-life confession, and it's a long one, to Dennis Couch, the Utah detective. And he talks about having her up there for one day. So she was probably in the cellar. I doubt if he took her up to his room. In any event, this is what Bundy said. She was at the apartment someplace, and so it means that they were there. And so, you know, you got to keep in mind, in Washington State, he had a lot. That was his territory, and he knew what he liked. He knew the forest areas, and he could make these kill sites and dump sites, and that's what he would do. He did not know the area nearly as well in Salt Lake City, Utah, and the surrounding counties. That's one of the reasons why he spent most of the time in that semester trolling and getting used to it. He had been there before because Liz and her parents lived not in Salt Lake, but I think in Ogden, Utah, but they had been in Salt Lake. But he got to know the area, you know, really well. At the same time, he was not dumping bodies in Utah in what they call dump sites, and he had at least two in Washington State, the Issaquah dump site and the Taylor Mountain dump site. So, and Taylor Mountain would not be discovered until March of 1975, but they found the Issaquah crime scene in September, like 8th, what we talked about, of 74. March 1st of 1975, they make the discovery of Taylor Mountain, which really was the place, we'll have to get into that later, but where he sequestered the heads. He probably buried the remainder of the bodies for the Taylor dump site there. Some bones were unearthed at Taylor Mountain that were later identified to these women, but there weren't a lot of them, and so that denotes burial. And so maybe some large predators dug parts of them up over a period, and but that's at the Taylor Mountain site. So in Utah, it's my estimation again that he kept them at his apartment, and he was bold enough to do that. And so then again, you have the abduction of Laura and Amy, and she wasn't found until Thanksgiving. I hope I pronounced this right. There was a Tippecanoe's Welcome Center off of the freeway there, and it also had trails that you could walk, and she was discovered on the morning, Thanksgiving morning, by two hikers, college students there, and it turns out that they were, I guess they looked to the left, and they spotted what they thought was a female body. They were convinced of it, and from then, they went back. They made some calls. The Welcome Center may have been shut down for people. Being Thanksgiving, you could probably walk in and walk out, you know, use a restroom or whatever. But they probably had to go to a phone and call, and that's when they brought. And again, I've seen the crime scene photos. I'll tell you that something. The most stark photo, you know, Bundy had done what he almost always did. He would strangle them from behind while he's having sex with them. And the picture of Laura and Amy, when you look at that picture, of the main picture, an up-close shot of her, where her tongue is protruding from her mouth because of the strangulation. When you look at the autopsy report, I mean, the people doing the autopsy report, they're very thorough. They're like, you know, the doctors doing that are just like the detectives. They have this describe these crime scenes. They just don't leave anything out. And when I read the autopsy reports, because I don't have the pictures, they were shown to me by Jim Massey, who had gotten them from Ron Holmes. And if I knew I was going to be writing about Bundy one day, this is just what I did, I would have made copies of not just those pictures, but I've read all the letters that Bundy had sent to Ron Holmes, and all the letters that Holmes sent to Bundy are now with Bob Keppel and his stuff. Okay, but nobody really has read these other letters, and I was able to read them one night because of Jim Massey, and yeah, they were interesting. But if I didn't know I was going to write a book on Bundy, I would have copied them all. But in any event, the pictures of Laura are stark, but these up close shots, it shows a woman. I'm talking about all this to let you know, she hasn't been dead very long at all. And, of course, that's why investigators think that she was kept alive somewhere. And they used to look for, I remember when I was doing research for one of the books, I think it was The Bundy Secrets, somebody was on a tangent that I knew looking for cabins where Bundy might have kept victims in Utah. I said, listen, just stop, because he's already, have you not heard the Dennis Couch confession? And they said, no. I said, there it is. He said, I took Deborah Kent back to my apartment. At, you know, and what he meant is 565 First Avenue. And Couch confirmed that. So, you know, until you know, you don't know. But in that case, I was able to help this one individual saying, you're really going down the wrong line there, because you're not going to find a cabin. He took them home. And so it's interesting. We can't prove that he had them in the apartment. We can't even prove he had them in the cellar, but we know he did. And from what Bundy told Michelle, he absolutely took them up to his apartment. He, you know, so anyway, it's an interesting, interesting thing. I mean, this is a guy, Bundy, that would do things that nobody believed were possible or would be possible. I mean, when we think we're normal people, and when a normal person thinks about abduction and murder, they automatically start thinking in terms of how they would do it, but they're handicapped by their own normalness, as it were. They're thinking in terms of normal and how they would do it. Bundy was anything but normal, and Bundy would get a great rush of doing things practically sometimes right out in front of people. And so, you know, what he told, you know, Michelle about how he did this and how he thought about himself as he was doing it explains why people like that, psychopaths, can do these things. When a normal person would think about doing it, they'd go, oh my gosh, I would never do that. I would do it another way. And of course, the other abduction, of course, was Deborah Kent, and of course that happened on November 8th, and that is the same night Carol DeRoche, that he had to have spotted coming onto the Fashion Place Mall in Murray, Utah, the property, driving her, I think it was a yellow Camaro, might have been red, I think it was yellow, I'm not sure, I can't remember, but it was a Camaro. And then he went up to her and did his Officer Roseland thing, and, you know, somebody tried to break in, you have a Camaro, and somebody tried to break in the car, can you follow me? And so she did out to the car. Interesting thing happened there, too, because the car was locked. She knew she locked it. He said, is there anything look missing? He said no. And then he goes, you know, could you unlock the car and get in? And that's an interesting thing, because she refused. And it's a good thing she did, because I have a sneaking suspicion Bundy was going to waylay her in her own car in some way, do something to her, and then maybe take off in her car. We don't know. But it was odd that he said, could you get in? This is her car. She didn't do it. And she was one to always wanting to obey authority, but she would disobey authority on this night and twice. And this was the first time. So then he goes back into the mall. He said, well, my partner's holding a suspect, so we'll go back into the mall. He said, oh, he's not here. They must have walked across the street. And of course, I've walked this. And then you go out on the other side of the doors, and you cross the side of the parking lot. State Street is on your left as you do this. And then you go across the little side street, and right in front of there, it's a cleaners and laundromat. But they have a side door, and that side door is marked 139. Well, I can tell you now that Bundy had all of this stuff already going in his head on what he was going to do. And he had to have pre-checked that that door would be locked. So he walks up to the door, and his Volkswagen, he doesn't even tell her this yet, but his Volkswagen is sitting off to the right on that little road that they just crossed, down about maybe 20, 30 feet, maybe 20 feet, probably not more than 20. And so he goes up and he tries the door, 139 on the side of the building. I've got a picture of it in the book. And it's locked. Of course, he knows it's locked. He said, well, listen, I'd like you to come with me to go to the Murray PD, which she knew was going to be, you got to go straight and hit State Street and then State Street and then follow it. She said, okay. She said, do you have a badge or something that I could see just in case? She'd already talked about it. She would tell later how handsome he was, how well-dressed he was. He kind of condescended. We kind of laughed at her for asking for a badge, which no real cop would do. He'd say, absolutely. In fact, he'd present the badge immediately. So he presented this badge, but he didn't really let her look at it long. So he gets into the Volkswagen. He puts her in the passenger seat, and he asks her to, I think he asked her to buckle up, and she said no. So I guess he locked the door. And then instead of going straight to State Street, he starts the car, puts it in gear, he had a shift, he turns the wheel all the way to the left, and he does a U-turn right there in this side street. He heads down about a half a block, comes to the stop sign. I don't know what it was called then, but when I was there in 2006 to do my research on the Bundy murders, it was Fashion Boulevard. That might have been the name then, but it may not have been. In any event, he takes a left at Fashion Boulevard, and he goes down not more than a block, block and a half, and he pulls alongside. And you got to remember, this is around 7:30. It got dark there about 5:15, 5:30, so it's nighttime. It's slightly drizzling, and he pulls up in front of the bus area where the buses would pull up to the McMillan Elementary School, and he would and he stopped the vehicle. Carol later said that he ran his car up on the wheels, the right wheels, accidentally up on the curb there, and came back down, and he immediately attacks her. Okay, she thinks he has a gun. The prosecutor later told me that he never used weapons like that, so we're not sure about it. Plus, she could never identify whether it was a revolver or an automatic, and you know, unless it was a flintlock, that's all there is, automatics, or which is really a semi-automatic. It's either that or it's a revolver. So the prosecutor's a little skeptical that Bundy had a gun, but she started fighting with him, and he went to get her the handcuffs on her right wrist, and he got one on, and then in the fight he made a mistake and got them on the second one. Now Carol doesn't even remember this. Carol thinks he left one of them dangling. He did not. That's what she said on the Netflix doc. That is incorrect. So I published her report at the Murray PD, and she got there. She got away from Bundy, and she knew he was trying to knock the heck out of her with a crowbar. She fought him hard. That's the only reason why she survived. And she jumped out of the car, and there was car lights coming down the road. And it was an old couple, Wilbur and Mary Walsh, and they picked her up and took her to the Murray PD. Well, they walked her into the PD. First thing they did, they sat her down, and they saw and made the report that both cuffs were attached to the right wrist. And they even named the detective who removed them. So she just can't remember, you know, just, and that happens with age. It's been 40 years, you know. So she gets in there, she tells what she knows, and of course Bundy, he's half in and half out of this altered state of murder. So what does he do? He goes, jumps in the car. He remembers the brochure that he had picked up a couple weeks earlier in Bountiful, Utah, where he also got gas, and he had been at the recreation center, and there was a brochure there, and it talked about the play The Redhead that would be showing on that Friday night of November 8th. So he's not going to go home without a victim. He's halfway in and out of this altered state of murder. So he heads to the neighborhood. He eventually jumps on I-15 going north. He makes it to Bountiful. There's a girl in the parking lot. He tries. Most of the people are inside. It's an auditorium that holds like 1,500 people. But there's a couple people milling about. And Bundy tried to get a girl to follow him from there. She said no. And then that was it. So Bundy goes inside. He exposes himself to these 1,500 people. And a lot of people out in the main area, because you go in the front doors and then you got a big hallway, and then you've got the auditorium is on the, past the little hallway right there. It's right there, and you could, all the doors were open, so he could see the huge crowd there. But there was also lots of people in like the foyer area. And so he makes an impression there, but he doesn't seem to be bothered by it. And of course, the play runs late. These little circumstances that happen. The play runs late, and one family at the play were the Kents, and Debbie was there. She was she had seen the play, but she wanted to see it again. The parents were wanting to see it. Her father, Dean Kent, had just recovered from a heart attack. You can imagine that. And that's his first night out. They're sitting on the left side of the auditorium, about maybe 8 or 10 seats down from the back of the auditorium. Running along the back of the auditorium is a brick half wall. And then you have your, main area for foot traffic. And then there is a, large wall that encases the auditorium. And then you get out through your little exits from that into the foyer, or you can exit the building on the east or west exits on those sides. Okay. So Bundy is doing he's acting weird to people. He's trying to get different women to go with him. He can't. He ends up being on that western portion or that left portion of the auditorium. And people later identified Bundy as being leaning on the half wall. He kind of split his time from leaning on that half wall and the back wall. And because the play ran late, Debbie decided to leave so that the parents wouldn't miss the play and take the family car and pick up one of her brothers at a roller rink. They said they'd be there like around 10 o'clock. And the play should have been over, but it ran late getting started. So the last thing that Belva Kent, the mom, said was, be careful, Deb, and hurry back. And what happens is she goes out the western side of the doors. I even did I was in there in 2006, took photographs of all these areas. But when I went back to do additional research for the Trail of Ted Bundy, the school was closed, so I couldn't go inside. But I did a video outside the school explaining all this so people could see that. That's online. But she came out the side doors. Yes.
We're going to have to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. That's why Ritual's founder is on a mission to reinvent the vitamin industry. Ritual has left out mystery additives, synthetic fillers, and shady extras that can be found in some traditional multivitamins, and they're committed to showing you their nutrients, where it came from, and why they chose it. They call it traceability. My wife Lisa decided to try Ritual about 5 months ago because of their claims to be a much better multivitamin for women. Lisa read all of the information about Ritual Essential for Women and was confident from that point that Ritual was a much different and better multivitamin. She continues to feel confident in what Ritual Essentials for Women is doing to contribute to her overall health every day. For obsessive label readers, Ritual uses vegan-certified, non-GMO, gluten-free, and allergen-free ingredients. And their sources are out there for the whole world to see because they believe you deserve to know what you're putting in your body and why. 40% of women cannot properly utilize the synthetic form of folate, folic acid, which can be found in many multivitamins. This is why Ritual uses folate in its absorbable form to help cover women's needs. Daily changes can lead to big results, so start small today. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Try it out, satisfaction guaranteed. Go to ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. So sorry to interrupt you, Kevin. We were right in the middle of this abduction of Deborah Kent with her parents at this play in this little high school. Continue with what Bundy is able to do, even though he's seen by many people at this auditorium that night. What does he end up doing? What happens with Deborah Kent?
Okay. So, as I was saying, Deborah Kent, she wants to spare her parents from missing the play, so she decides to go pick up one of her brothers at a local roller rink. So she goes out the doors of the auditorium, which leads straight out. Instead of going out the front door, she goes out the doors which were on the left of the auditorium, and that led her out into the West End parking lot. Bundy sees this. Now, Bundy could have absolutely gone the same way. He could have absolutely gone and gotten to her quicker going that way. Instead of that, he hurries back in the opposite direction, goes out the front exit, then goes through the main doors, and then he's really trying to pick up some speed while he goes down a sidewalk area. He doesn't realize it, but in doing so, he must have been going for his keys or something because he dropped the handcuff key, and that would be found by Ira Beale's people the next day. So he catches up with her, and now, you remember, it's dark. It's close to 10 o'clock. Probably isn't raining anymore. There's no people out in the parking lot because the play is not over. There are apartments across the street from the school and some houses next to the school. And a number of people came forward later and said they heard a high-pitched scream coming from the parking lot. And one person said followed by maybe, I think somebody said maybe there was like a second scream, but we know there was at least one scream. And what happened is Bundy, what he most likely did was, and he didn't have to get in his car for it, he probably had already placed his crowbar underneath his car. And he must have, just as Debbie was trying to get into her car, he was able to attack her, strike her, and overwhelm her. And he must have hit her quite hard. And he knew that she would be out for some time. What he didn't do was throw her into the car and leave immediately. He put her in the car, he just probably threw a blanket over her, and he went back inside. Now, until this occurred, anybody who had seen Bundy prior to this, like the drama teacher, Raylan Shepard, who tried to get, you know, Raylan to go out with him to, quote, identify a car in the parking lot, unquote. So he, you know, he was acting like a police officer again. And she wouldn't do it. She saw him the last time after this had happened to Debbie, but she didn't know it. And instead of being like well-dressed and his normal self as she had been before, she and some other people said that he was winded. His shirt tail, one of the shirt tails was hanging out. He just looked like a kind of like a mess. Well, nobody really talked about that before, but my theory was this. After he abducted her, he had to whack her. He had to struggle with her. He had to knock her out, and then he had to lift her body into his car, which left him winded, which left him with his one of his shirt tails hanging out. And I think the reason why he did that is to at least present somewhat of an alibi that people had seen him there before Kent left and after Kent left, and that, because that's the only thing that we can think why he did that for. There would be no reason to go back in there. Also, somebody reported, not at the time of the scream, but at a time factor that would be later than around when the scream would have occurred, but still with nobody else really out in the parking lot, a Volkswagen take off at rather high speed. And, of course, that would be Bundy getting out of there. In fact, Bundy, when people noticed him looking winded and the shirt tail out, he actually tried to, instead of along the half wall, leaning on the half wall of the back, he actually sat in an empty seat. And when Bundy saw Raylan Shepard staring at him and pointing out to her husband, this guy, that unnerved him. So that's when he got up and left. And I also talk about there's an odd coincidence that happened that, without knowing it, Bundy had rubbed shoulders with a future victim. Because in that in that play, The Redhead, at Viewmont High School on November 8th of 1974, there was a girl named Susan Curtis. And she would be Bundy's future victim that he would get later. Right. She went to a Bountiful Youth Conference, yes, at Brigham Young University, and this was for like high school kids. They had a youth conference there, and that was, you know, and that's located down in Ogden, Utah. In fact, Susan had ridden with her friends on a 2-day bike ride from up in Bountiful down to Ogden, and she enjoyed it very much. But in any event, yeah, I mean, it's real creepy when you think about these oddities and these circumstances that occur. But the thing people need to remember about Bundy is when you look at these kind of abductions from Lake Sammamish to coming in and exposing himself to 1,500 people at Viewmont High School in Bountiful, Utah, and just some of the other wild things that he did, the Linda Ann Healy abduction, this is a guy that would do practically anything. And again, most normal people, they don't think in terms of this, and they think, well, there surely wouldn't be anybody that would do this. Oh, yes, there are. Not everybody would have the savvy to carry out the kind of murders that Bundy did, even if they're psychopaths, and to get away with it so long. But again, Bundy was a very skilled planner of murder, and it's just odd. He would just get away with one murder after another.
Well, let's talk about one that is particularly brazen, we'll say, lack of a better term, and this is in Colorado. You call this chapter A Lethal Colorado Winter, 1975. He left Utah for Colorado, and people know this story, but it's definitely worth exploring again, the Wildwood Inn with Karen Campbell.
Yes.
How brazen an attack was this? Tell our audience about this Karen Campbell.
Yes. That's an interesting case. And I'm always going to be eternally grateful for all the investigators that work these cases, that work with me in the writing of my book, The Bundy Murders. Mike Fisher and I got really close. Mm-hmm. He just really opened up to me, and he told me things that he was not comfortable telling to the general public back then. And but you know, this is 20 years later after Bundy's execution. I'm contacting him, and we really became friends. And he wrote out a lot of stuff for me and emailed it, and we talked a lot on the phones. But he talks about things, and I really give him a lot of praise in my book. He's just an astute lawman. Well, the Wildwood Inn was a strange abduction, and what happened was that there was a medical conference in Aspen at Snowmass, which is like Aspen, Snowmass. It's all right there, you know, the lodges. You got Aspen at the bottom, and they got all these lodges up on the hill, and the Snowmass Lodge, the Wildwood Inn, is, you know, way up there. And attending the medical conference was Dr. Raymond Godowski from Michigan, his girlfriend, who was a nurse, Karen Campbell, their mutual friend and also a former boyfriend, Dr. Rosenthal. Now, I only use three pseudonyms in my book, The Bundy Murders, for Diane Edwards, for Dr. Rosenthal, I call him Dr. Brinkman, and for Karen Sparks, I use Terry Caldwell. Truth be told, I thought Sparks was not a real name. But I might use the pseudonym anyway. But everybody else's name is in there. But I purposely didn't do it for Rosenthal or for Edwards. I just thought it would be more appropriate. But they came from Michigan, and they weren't there 24 hours until this terrible thing happened. And what happened is, and here's the thing, this is really interesting, because I wrote about this in depth in the Bundy murders. And I remember Fisher telling me, he said, you know, the Wildwood Inn, and at the time he's telling me this, and I'm doing a lot of research, I had never been there. But he said the Wildwood Inn is kind of like a horseshoe-shaped building, a variety of buildings, but there is a very popular outdoor heated pool. And he said that pool in these deep cold of a Colorado winter will constantly emit steam. He said it can get so heavy that, you know, you can see people and then they disappear. They kind of come into focus, they go away. And so Bundy's not stupid, and he could see that. And he knew that such a factor would aid in what he wanted to do. And so Mike Fisher gave me a lot of information. We talked about a lot of things. And so on that evening, Karen Campbell wasn't feeling well, and they went to Snowman's Village. There's a place that's right there called the Stewpot Inn, and it's still there. And she didn't want to eat a whole lot, but she got a bowl of stew, and she got a glass of milk, and she didn't finish either of them. And they went back to the, and also I just, I'm just going to throw this out. It's not usually wise to have your wife around somebody that she used to sleep with. I mean, I know that they were all friends, but the dynamics of the sexual relationships among people, when you know that that has gone on, it can sometimes create issues with people. And I didn't go into this in great detail then, but I knew it was probably there were some issues going on. All the record says, and what Mike and I talked about is that when Dr. Rosenthal and Dr. Godowski and the two kids and Karen Campbell went back from having dinner at the Stewpot Inn, he flopped in a chair, Dr. Godowski, in the sunken bar area where the fireplace, I've been there, it's really nice. And they had stopped off at a little drugstore after at the Stewpot Inn that's right there, and they were perusing the magazines. And Dr. Rosenthal, I think he had a a penthouse or a hustler. I think it's a hustler. And Karen had a Viva. Now, Viva was kind of like a somewhat erotic magazine for females back then. And I know in the encyclopedia, I put the dates of when the magazine started and when it ended, but it was nothing like a hustler. But it was still one of those kind of like erotic things. So they were laughing about it, and they decided to exchange magazines. So Karen had said to Dr. Godowsky, you know, Raymond Godowsky, could you go get my magazine? They had a room in 210. He said no. He refused to do it. And you get the sense when you read the record that he must have been irritated about something. And I kind of think I know what that is, but I don't write about it. But so Rosenthal goes off to get his magazine. She goes off to get her. Now, here's, again, circumstances. How circumstances determine whether you're going to get abducted or you're not. The kids, Godowsky's kids, wanted to go with Karen to her room. She allowed them to walk to the elevator where she was going to take it, but then she sent them back to their dad. Had she taken the kids with her, there isn't any way that she would have been abducted. She'd be alive and breathing right now unless she was killed in a car wreck or something. So she goes up. Now, at the time Mike's telling me all this, we covered so much stuff. And I reproduce a lot of his emails and information verbatim for the next Bundy book after the Bundy murders, The Trail of Ted Bundy. But I didn't know that Mike knew exactly how he got her. And he did a fantastic job, Mike did, of interviewing people in the middle of the night there, getting names. It took him a long time to track Bundy down with this. But she goes up the elevator. I see in the first edition of the Bundy murders that he must have been standing back out of the shadows on the second floor near like a closet area for that they had there. The walkways, you know, if the steam's not going on, you can see everything from all angles. First floor, second floor, it doesn't matter. And I was assuming that because there was a woman named Elizabeth Harder that saw Bundy by the elevator, I think everybody assumed that was on the second floor. So as she got out, he must have said something to her then. It turns out that Bundy gave Mike Fisher gave a news conference afterwards, and I remember Mike telling me, and I saw this in the article, that before Bundy had gone up to the Wildwood Inn, he spent time in Aspen, like driving around and hunting for victims down there. And then he went up, as Bundy said, amongst the lodges. And he ended up at this thing. It turns out that Mike had mentioned how she was abducted in an article to the Aspen Times after he returned from the execution of Bundy in January of 1989. And here's what he said, and so I've added this to the second edition. And I wasn't aware of this. He wasn't keeping it from me. We talked about so many, 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 many things. We just never hit on this. What he did was, Harder did see him, and he was by the elevator. The elevator most likely on the first floor. And Bundy admitted to Fisher that there was a particular woman that, as cold as it was, he was trying to get her to go with him to help him, like he was on crutches. When Harder saw him, must have laid the crutches down and was just standing there because she didn't see any crutches. And he had also ski boots, but he had laid those down too, and she didn't see those. But according to what Mike said, that she saw that after Harder saw him, Karen, who had taken the elevator up, was walking across the outdoor balcony, and as the steam parted for a second, she saw Bundy on crutches. And so she's a nurse. She asked him if he needed help. Well, Bundy wanted this other woman. He wanted to get this other woman. But when she offered that, he said yes. And what Bundy said, what he did was that she helped him She may have come down the first floor. He may have gone up the second floor, and then they went down the steps from the outside. They had parked in the – they have a big parking lot on the left. You can park some in a couple of areas, but their main parking lot is on the left of the building. So I got a picture that I took of a stairs leading down from the pool area. It's an outside stairs. That's probably what they came down and then turned left, went into the parking lot. But Bundy said when they got to the car – and no doubt, and probably didn't have the crowbar out this time or he would have used it, as she was apparently putting the crutches in his car, he took the ski boots and hit her in the head and knocked her out. Now, he would tell Mike Fisher, and of course, after he did that, he probably struck her one time with a crowbar because that's what he told Fisher. He said, just like all the others, I hit her just once, probably with a crowbar, didn't kill her. Knocked her out. He took her 2.8 miles away. There's a road called the Owl Creek Road. It leads right out of that village. Once you get down, you can go on Owl Creek Road. He went 2.8 miles away, and he told Fisher, I did my thing right there in the car. And that's in the first edition. And so, but I've added this extra stuff. So here's this wild abduction, and he gets away with it. And then he said he left. Some people think he stayed around, maybe came back to the inlet. No, he says real clearly in the record, he said he got away from there on what he termed it, slick back roads. And so it's a fantastic, an odd abduction. Of course, Dr. Godowsky had to call the police. That's when Mike first, got a call from Sheriff Bill Baldridge and so they end up going to the Wildwood Inn and interviewing him. And they stayed the rest of the time at the medical conference and, went back. But, Mike wasn't thinking he was involved. But he did polygraph him while he was there. It didn't exonerate him. It certainly didn't make him guilty. I don't know what the word they're using. I can't think of it. What the same word I use in the book, but it was not. He wasn't showing any signs of deception at all. And then he would take a later one with Mike when Mike visited Michigan, and he passed with flying colors. Now, of course, the children were there, and they backed up the dad's story. So Mike didn't really think they were suspects, but as a good detective, he had to completely rule them out, and he had to rule out Raymond Godowsky and also Dr. Rosenthal. And so. So one thing led to another. And a year later, when he was back there, he talked to this Elizabeth Harder, and she identified Bundy as being the one. And, of course, when that happened, he knew that he was on the hunt for the right, right guy. He later determined that because he and Jerry Thompson had been working together because both of them had missing and murdered women in their state in Colorado and Utah, back up to each other, and so they shared their information freely. And Jerry had gotten Bundy's gas receipts, and then that was a great thing because then it showed Bundy being in the areas where these women disappeared at the time they disappeared, and he's using his gas card. So they knew they had the right guy. A terrible, terrible thing happened though. Elizabeth Harder ended up identifying somebody else during his trial, And Fisher always believed that it could have been something like, and she's dead now, I can say this, but I don't think she's alive anymore, but he always felt like it was perhaps because she was maybe against the death penalty, and this was a death penalty case. But he wasn't sure, but she just misidentified him. Now, later, I had a fellow tell me that it might have been an honest mistake because there was a fellow there that kind of looked like Bundy, but was not. So anyway, it very interesting case.
You have at the same time, around the same time or after this, a friend talks to Liz Kendall and says, look, these things are happening in Utah. So she urges her to call police, and she talks to somebody named Captain Hayward. Captain Hayward says to her, look, we've checked him out. He's just a law student. It's okay. Now he continues his killing spree. But we get to August 15th, 1975, and There is a Sergeant Bob Hayward of Utah Highway Patrol. Pardon me, it's not August 15th. Pardon me, it's August 6th. You say around 2:30. Tell us about incredible. Tell us about this encounter and maybe correct me on the date then.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, it is August 16th. August, he wasn't booked until the 16th. It was in the early morning hours. So this would be, I guess, on the 15th. But
okay.
He was, the Highway Patrol fella is Bob Hayward. He's the brother of the homicide captain in Salt Lake City at the Sheriff's Department, Pete Hayward. And so they were brothers. And in fact, Bob Hayward, somebody told me when I was researching the book, somebody had mentioned that he was dead, and I knew Pete was dead. And but I had his report. I had everything. I didn't need to talk to him, but it would have been nice. I would have liked to have said hello. But in any event, he didn't die until, I think, about a year and a half ago. Really old fellow when he died. But he had Bundy was such a liar. When he was arrested that night, and it came out that who he was, you know, he even tell people, I wasn't even hunting that night. That's a lie. He had removed the passenger seat.
Yeah.
And that was lying in the back seat. And he had his murder kit. Get this. The murder kit was not just sitting inside the car. It was unzipped, and the bag was unzipped, and some of the stuff was, like, spilling out of it. Well, around 2 o'clock in Granger, Utah, a small suburb, he's sitting there, he's smoking a joint, and he's got a map out. He's trying to figure out his way back to his home. And Bob Hayward is just getting off work, and he sees Bundy, and he observes him for a little bit. But when Hayward turns his lights on again and starts coming at him, it freaks Bundy out. He starts the car. He takes off. Dumbest thing he could have done. And the reason why Hayward was paying special attention to him, apparently his neighborhood had suffered, just a normal neighborhood, but it certainly wasn't a bad area. It had suffered a rash of burglaries lately. He thought, well, maybe this guy, why would there be a guy sitting at 2 o'clock in the morning? So obviously it was a suspicious deal. So Bundy tries to flee. He's not going to be able to flee. He's never going to outrun that cop car. He goes. He starts off with his lights off, and he ends up turning them on. He runs through a couple of stop signs. Then he gets out on more of a main road. I think it's 35, but I can't remember. Turns left. He's not going to get away from him. And so what he ends up doing is pulling into a place where a gas station used to be. I believe it was out of business. And, of course, that is – It's how that happened. And, of course, Hayward, when he gets out of the car, he's going to schmooze the cop, no doubt. And I have added this to that, to the new edition, but instead of carrying a simple .38 revolver like most police officers did, Bob carried a .357 Magnum. You can also fire .38 shells through that, but he carried the actual Magnum, which is not normally standard issue for patrolmen, usually back in that time of the 1970s. But it may have been with his department. I don't know, Highway Patrol. I guess maybe it was. But for local police departments, it's usually not. It's usually a .38 special back then. So he opens his door a crack, and he sticks the Magnum out between his door, tells Bundy to stop. Of course, then, you know, he goes up, and he looks at the car. Bundy gives him permission to, you know, look at it and get – go inside of it. But what Hayward does, he looks in there and he sees immediately that the passenger seat is gone, and then he sees this bag. So he calls the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, and he gets a couple patrol officers out there, and they also send Detective Daryl Ondrak out there.
Right.
And Ondrak comes out there, and of course Ondrak takes a look at this stuff. And, you know, Hayward already said, look, Mr. Bundy, I'm going to arrest you tonight for evading a police officer and also being in possession of burglary tools. But the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, if they had a deal like that, they would often charge somebody with burglary tools just to get them in jail. And then if they had to amend that to something else, they would do so later. But when Andrak saw that stuff, he thought, no, this is, you know, this is more than just, he's carrying stuff that burglars don't carry. He's carrying, you know, rope. He's carrying sheets, bed sheets that have been tied, that have been torn in strips, like for binding hands or feet. So, you know, detectives, they look at this, they go, this isn't normal burglars. We're somebody like trying to abduct somebody. It's just, it's different, but charged with burglary, and he goes. Well, from that moment on, it was Bundy the Hunter has now become Bundy the Hunted. And from that moment on, he would never kill again until Florida. But, you know, he just, so it was a very pivotal moment for everybody. And, you know, it's almost like an epiphany happened that once this unveiling occurred, it's like the scales from everybody's eyes just fell off, and everybody knew that this man who had been killing in the Pacific Northwest and in Utah and even in Oregon, abducted Parks from there, and then Colorado, and then Idaho, and you know, we haven't even covered the abduction of, like, you know, the 12-year-old girl, you know, Lynette Culver from Pocatello, Idaho. But you know, it's him. Everybody knew it's him, and there was no denying it, and there was no doubt. I remember Thompson said to me once, and I quoted him in the book, he said, when I got the gas receipts, you know, he tried to keep an open mind before then, but he said, when I got the gas receipts and I saw that Bundy was in these areas at the same time that these young women were disappearing, he said, I knew there wasn't any way it wasn't him. And so the scales fell from everybody's eyes at one time, and then from that moment on, it was you know, Bundy was in survival mode. And I say that he probably didn't know where it was all going to go when he walked home that night. They impounded his car of August 16, 1975, but he would soon find out. And of course, you know, within a few months, because of the investigation into this guy, Bundy, he would be charged in October of 75 with the abduction of Carol LaRoche. And they also wanted to charge him with attempted murder, but they had to then amend that to just, because there was no proof that he was going to murder her, even though they knew he would have. And so, you know, from that moment on, and then it's an interesting thing. You know, after he gets out of jail with that on bail and he's hired an attorney, he's allowed to go back to his home in Seattle. And he, you know, for like late in the fall, late November, I think he arrived there in like December 1st. And he would not have to return to Salt Lake City until around, I think, around mid-February. And, you know, so when he was released on jail, Thompson called Heppel's people and said, I'm going to give you a heads up that he's been released and there's no restrictions on travel and he's going to come there. And they already anticipated he'd go there. And because Seattle authorities, Heppel's people, were working with a couple psychiatrists and psychologists on what kind of person they're dealing with the murdering of these women, and now they know it's Bundy. They said, the psychiatric people said, you're going to have to keep him under surveillance, and he's going to have to know he's under surveillance. Because it's only him knowing he's under surveillance that will cause him not to commit another act. And they said, even if you can't keep your eyes on him 24/7, although you need to try to do that, he's got to feel that pressure of being under surveillance. And so I call it like a thing of a predator under glass. And Bundy has a hard time with it. He had a hard time with it in Utah as well. And for this last one, November, I republished all of those surveillance things that happened with him in Utah. But in the Bundy murders, I only added the very, you know, interesting ones of what happened in Seattle, the Seattle area. And then in one of the books, I think maybe the Bundy Secrets, I published all the surveillance things for people to see later. So it's interesting. And so again, Bundy would never murder again. of course, you know, here's what happened, and I'm just going to say it. He gets 1 to 15 years in Utah State Prison, nicknamed Point of the Mountain Prison, for the abduction of Carol Hodge. Mike Fisher gets a warrant placed against him for the Colorado murder of Karen Campbell. They transferred to the jail there, and Fisher took him there with two other people personally. He and Fisher and Thompson warned them, you got to watch this guy. He escapes once, is recaptured, and then escapes a second time. I mean, these are Keystone cops who were running these jails, I'm telling you. That's what the paper called them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he gets to Florida, comes through Louisville, doesn't murder anybody, gets to Florida, and sets up shop down there and ends up committing two murders, kind of mega murders. And in his last murder, just like Lynette Culver was 12, he ends up murdering Kimberly Leach on February 9th, 1978. And he is then arrested. Nobody knows who he is, but he's arrested as he tries to flee the state in Pensacola on, I think, the 15th of February. And so then after that, that's the end of the road. And then it's just a slow journey to the execution chamber.
Yes. You add so much incredible detail in this, the Bundy murders, and it's such an exciting story for all the twists and turns, the escapes. And it's interesting, too, when you talk about Thompson and Fisher pleading with these authorities that this is the kind of guy that wants to escape and remarkably escapes and then is allowed somehow to escape again, and his carnage continue. This story should have ended right here because it was enough missteps.
Yeah.
He had eluded authorities in six states and murdered almost at will this guy, and yet, at the same time, he was allowed to continue this. And and as you write, he was a much different person when he was killing in Florida. Once he got down there, he was a much, much different person and a much different killer, wasn't he?
Oh, he was. He was actually spiraling downward. And people would notice him sometimes unkempt and dirty, and he wasn't. And this is interesting. He had lost his ability in Florida to draw women to him as he had in Washington State and even in Utah. He had lost that ability, but it wasn't just that. Women were kind of repulsed by him. I remember the women on the Chi Omega, the night he attacked Chi Omega, the women at Sherrod's, which was a disco right next door to Chi Omega, said, "Man, I don't want this guy to ask me to dance." And they said he was putting off these weird vibes. Just like the one lady said, I think her name is Carla Black, she said, it's like he had this almost like a smirk on his face, like, "I know something that you don't know." And so he was not the suave killer of 1974. Those days were over.
I want to thank you very much, Kevin Sullivan, for coming on and talking about the Bundy murders, a comprehensive history. This is the second edition, and we've been listeners have been listening to part two of our interview, continued from last week. For those that might want to take a look at this, is there a Facebook page? Tell us how they might find out more information about this book, Bundy book, and all of your other Bundy books.
Yes. Well, you can all there's actually two ways. There, you can go to my author page on Amazon, and it lists all my books. And they still sell the Bundy murders, first edition, and it sells well. And there's now the second edition sells well, and it makes me wonder, do the people buying the first know that the second's out there? But they're both on Amazon and all my other books. Or you can go to Wild Blue Press. I'm an author there. I publish mostly through Wild Blue Press now, but I've got a number of publishers, and of course, the Bundy murders was with McFarland. So either spot, and of course, if people want to contact me and connect with me on Facebook, I am there as well.
That's been great. Thank you very much. It's always an absolute pleasure to speak to the absolute authority on all things Ted Bundy. Thank you very much, Kevin Sullivan, for talking about the Bundy murders, a comprehensive history. It certainly is. Thank you very much, Kevin, and have a great night.
Thank you, Dan. And we'll see you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.